Vanaf 1 juli moeten alle reizen van medewerkers gerapporteerd worden. Gelukkig maakt Shuttle die CO2-rapportage eenvoudig. Shuttle geeft medewerkers toegang tot alle vormen van vervoer en maakt automatisch een rapportage. Shuttle maakt mobiliteit voor iedereen leuker. Ga naar shuttle.nl.
Dit is een BNR-podcast.
De Perestrooikast. Een blik op Oost-Europa.
Welkom bij BNR Perestrooikast, aflevering 214 van de enige podcast van Nederland die volledig oog voor het Oosten heeft en geeft. Wederom een aflevering zonder Floris, dus dat is vast weer een teleurstelling voor je, in ieder geval voor mij. Maar hij komt snel weer terug, dat beloof ik je. En dat heeft hij mij ook beloofd. Nadat we in aflevering 213 aandacht hadden voor Slowakije, schuiven we weer een landje verder oostwaarts. En dat betekent dat we weer naar Oekraïne gaan. En ditmaal voor een verslag van binnenuit.
Near the Ukrainian city of Kupiansk, white concrete barricades and coils of razor wire stretch for more than a mile. Trenches with basic living quarters are being dug here under cover of darkness. Artillery rumbles can be heard nearby. These are the country's new northeastern defensive lines. It's part of a shift in military operations against Russia to a more defensive footing.
Dit is de voice-over van persbureau Reuters van een Oekraïense cameraman ter plaatse. Dat is dan bij Kupiansk. Dat is een stadje in de regio Kharkiv waar de Russen graag weer opnieuw bezit van nemen. Belangrijk logistiek knooppunt. Oekraïne wapent zich daartegen met nieuwe verdedigende linies. En iemand die daar is geweest bij die nieuwe Oekraïense loopgraven waar Zelensky nog maar kort geleden eigenlijk opdracht toe heeft gegeven, dat is Francis Farrell. Hij is verslaggever bij de Kiev Independent en we spreken hem zo dadelijk over wat hij heeft gezien en waarom Oekraïners toch wel teleurgesteld zijn in de komst van deze linies, ook al is het misschien bittere noodzaak.
Now it's Ukraine's turn to defend and they might be defending for a very long time. And so it's, you know, in a situation where they need to save ammunition, they need to save their own people, their own equipment. It's just vitally important that they defend as effectively as possible. The problem is that this decision wasn't made until when it was really needed.
En je weet het inmiddels, alles ten oosten van de rivier de Elbe kan de komende weken, maanden, jaren in deze perestrooikasten worden besproken. En wat leuk is dat we heel sociaal en democratisch zijn. Abonneer je op ons. Dat kan via je favoriete podcast-app of via BNR. En ga dan naar Perestrooikast en geef ons ook even een recensie of een rating met een aantal sterren. En daar profiteren andere potentiële luisteraars weer van mee. Volgende week is hij er echt weer, Floris Akkerman. Tot dan moet je het met mij doen. Geert-Jan Haan, dit is BNR Perestrooikast.
Момент сутужний бачимо, іде залужений, і несе нам дві лопати, генерал завзятий, каже Гриша, каже Вова, щоб наблизить перемогу і Московію здолати, треба наступати. Я кум дві лопати в руках.
Ik, mijn vriend en twee schoppen. Dat is eigenlijk de titel van deze videoclip en van het nummer dat je zojuist hoorde. Je hoorde een fragment ervan. Een link zie je in de show notes. Maar voordat we in Oekraïne duiken, eerst nog even een klein beetje zelfpromotie. 12 februari staan Floris en ik in Nieuwspoort voor het maken van BNR Perestrooikast live. Jawel, het is een evenement. Het is dus niet alleen een podcast. Er is een quiz, er zijn anekdotes, er is duiding. En ter ere van 5 jaar Perestrooikast doen we dit. Maar ook eerlijk gezegd omdat het moment nadert dat Rusland al 10 jaar lang oorlog voert met Oekraïne. Floris en ik waren in Oekraïne toen de Krim werd geannexeerd en de oorlog in de Donbass begon. Net als onze gasten Kiesje Hekster en Bob Deen. Kaarten gaan naar haagscollege.nl/college/perestrooikast of check gewoon de show notes en reserveer dan gelijk een ticket. Het gaat hard, dat zei ik de vorige keer ook al, dus het gaat harder. En als je ons 12 februari 's avonds in Nieuwspoort wil zien en spreken, boek dan dus nu dat ticket. Oekraïne gaat in de verdediging. Het gaat een netwerk van verdedigingslinies bouwen en wil zich daarmee defensiever opstellen tegen nieuwe Russische militaire offensieven. Misschien wel door het gebrek aan mensen en het gebrek aan materieel en het gebrek aan munitie. President Zelensky en minister Fedorov die hebben opdracht hiertoe gegeven. Zij zijn op verschillende plekken aan het front geweest. Dat was in november, in december. En toen kwamen ze tot de conclusie: Oekraïne moet in de verdediging. Betrekkelijk laat, wellicht. En een van die linies is door Francis Farrell al bezocht. En hij komt erover vertellen. Dit gesprek voeren we in het Engels. En een link bij het artikel van Francis en bij meer artikelen van hem vind je natuurlijk in de show notes.
Francis, thanks for joining this podcast.
Yeah, good to be here.
I want to talk with you about two important stories that you wrote recently. One story you published this week is about mobilization in Ukraine, drafting new soldiers. We know that Ukraine needs a lot. Zaluzhny and Zelensky, they also mentioned in the end a figure somewhere around 500,000 Ukrainians would be necessary to defend the country against Russian aggression for at least a full year. But let's start with another story you wrote about Ukraine. I think it was like a month ago, about Ukraine finally fortifying the front line. And that's something that's not really in the news, not in the Netherlands at least. And you're raising a very important question there. Is it not too late for Ukraine to think defensively?
Yeah, so thank you. I mean, it's kind of my the topic I'm a bit obsessed with at the moment because of the situation in the war and how I see it. So I guess the topic of fortification needs to be framed in the phase of the war that we are now. So if we go back just half a year, if you remember, it was summer and the Russian offensives around Bakhmut had all finished and the Ukrainian counteroffensive had started. So this is the big thing everyone was waiting for. They got their Western tanks and a lot more ammunition that they saved up. They made new brigades that were trained in NATO countries. And they had started this counteroffensive, and it was still going slowly a half a year ago when it just started. But people thought, you know, maybe bit by bit, there's a breakthrough just over the horizon. And that didn't happen, right? I don't want to just say failure, but it basically was a failure to achieve its goals, because its goals were breaking through the Russian lines, capturing a large amount of territory and changing the game strategically. And unfortunately, the counteroffensive didn't do any of those things. And one of the main reasons was the way that the Russians were able to really effectively fortify their own front line. So I had soldiers telling me that, you know, we can make fun of the Russians here or there, but one thing they're almost maybe the best in the world at is digging and fortifying. It's like old Soviet doctrine. They just have the instructions. They put the concrete bunkers here, the anti-tank trenches here, the dragon's teeth here, and they created this really formidable system, and Ukraine just couldn't break through. And so not only does that episode kind of prove how important fortifications are, because we know that attacking is more difficult than defending, and there's this figure of 3-1, the attacker should have an advantage in numbers and firepower, and the defending side will take less losses. But it all depends on how effectively that defending side is dug in. You know, if they're just defending houses and shallow trenches, that's nothing compared to them defending a very well-prepared fortification system. And so that proved how important that was. But what also happened with the counteroffensive kind of failing was that now it was Russia's turn to attack. And they immediately did. As soon as the counteroffensive kind of stopped moving, we saw in the middle of October, immediately they started trying to surround Avdiivka, and since then they're still attacking there, and they've also pushed in other parts of the front line. And unfortunately, in the context of where we are now with the foreign aid, with, you know, there's a lot of questions now about whether the US will pass this crucial funding for more military aid to Ukraine. There's also money being locked up in the European Union. So it's just very unlikely to see Ukraine being in a position, probably at any point in 2024, maybe, but very unlikely that they'll be able to do another big counteroffensive, right? What we do see is we see Russia on the attack, probably with the initiative for months and months and months. And so now it's Ukraine's turn to defend, and they might be defending for a very long time. And so it's, you know, in a situation where they need to save ammunition, they need to save their own people, their own equipment. It's just vitally important that they defend as effectively as possible. The problem is that this decision wasn't made for, you know, until when it was really needed, but it should have been done months ago. When Russia was attacking a year ago around Bakhmut, they were preparing already in advance for the Ukrainian counteroffensive, and they were digging these fortifications on the southern front line. But while Ukraine was attacking, they did not do that. They didn't prepare for Russia to attack back. And there are a few reasons why. There are two main reasons. First of all, politically, it doesn't look good, right? When your outward narrative is that, you know, Ukraine has not abandoned these occupied territories, we don't want to freeze the conflict because that will just abandon our people and give Russia a chance to regroup. And so the narrative is that we're always going forward, whereas in reality, you know, and so if that's your narrative and you start building huge fortifications along the existing front line, then that doesn't really make too much sense. But the other problem is that unlike Russia, where you have a totalitarian power vertical system, very similar, maybe even to the Soviet Union at this point, when it comes to the allocation of state resources, it's very simple to allocate the resources and give the orders to build these things down this power vertical. You just have the president, and he just says, "Well, you guys, defense ministry, maybe infrastructure ministry, get some civilian migrants, do whatever you need to do. I just need these fortifications," and they'll do it. Whereas in Ukraine, it's a lot more complicated because this is something you need extra money for. It's something you need civilian construction companies for. The military cannot do something of this scale on their own, and they're busy fighting. But you do need to coordinate with the military as well. And so that's, you know, in this more democratic, I guess, structure of Ukraine, it doesn't necessarily immediately suit such a task as building fortifications. But now they've finally started, and we'll see how it goes.
How do they decide where to fortify? Like, you've been to Bakhmut, you've recently been to the region of Avdiivka as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
We see Avdiivka is under enormous pressure, Kupiansk is under enormous pressure. So where to decide where you fortify this new front line? Because it also brings back bad memories of the demarcation line, which was followed up by Minsk 1, Minsk 2. So it must be a very tough decision.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, according to, if Ukraine were to do something similar to what the Russians were doing, they would have, you know, the first line positions, which are very close to the zero line, and you would have a lot of minefields. That's another thing, you know, this whole thing about Ukraine having millions of mines littering all over it, which many of them were placed by the Russians. But now it's another kind of philosophical question. If Ukraine is planning to go forward and liberate its territory, does it, you know, it probably doesn't feel very good about laying millions of its own mines, but it might have to, and we'll see if that happens. But yeah, you have those first lines, those minefields, and then you have the second line, or perhaps the main line, again, if it's similar to what Russia does, which would be about 10 kilometers back from the front line, which allows the construction to go ahead in a much safer way than it is much closer, because you're out of range of a lot of enemy mortars and drones. And then you could have, you know, a third line even further back. But the problem with these lines further back, again, it suggests that maybe Ukraine will even have to retreat to these lines. And then there are still cities, like you mentioned, Kupiansk, for example, which are too close. So it's like, do you build the fortifications around Kupiansk or behind Kupiansk? It's a really tricky one. But again, like, these are the decisions that need to be made now, because what we have is the paradigm shifted. Again, as I mentioned, half a year ago, it was about, okay, maybe the counteroffensive will succeed and we'll march forward to complete victory, or maybe it will fail and maybe it'll be more of a stalemate. But now, once we've reached this point, we see that the reality is maybe like a stalemate for now, at least for this year, is a good scenario. But the bad scenario is Russia marching forward and taking a lot more of Ukraine and maybe degrading the Ukrainian armed forces to the point where they won't be able to resist at all, which is obviously the worst scenario. But in that case, they need to dig in and fortify.
Yeah. I also read in your story that Defense Ministry confirmed to you that the plans for the fortifications are to stretch along the entire line of contact. That's enormous. That's like, I don't know, does it mean from Kupiansk till Kherson? So are we talking about 1,000 kilometers?
Well, it's more than that, actually, because in this sense, unfortunately, the contact line also includes the state border between Ukraine and Russia, and even between Ukraine and Belarus, technically. That's perhaps a little less high risk at this point, because that hasn't been a threat for a long time. But, you know, that is also part of the contact line where Russian troops could gather and conduct an offensive from. So it wouldn't make sense only to fortify the front line within Ukraine, because if you focus all on that, then they might concentrate forces somewhere else and attack, and you won't be prepared. So, and again, we need a bit of time to see how they actually do it. But, you know, we have seen videos posted by the armed forces and the defense ministry of fortifications being dug exactly on this border with Russia and Belarus, and away from front lines. And I mean, I have mixed feelings about that, because I understand that it's important, as I said, to fortify that as well. But I think that the front line, the battlefield front line is a higher priority at this point, because that is where the war is being actively fought. But it's a huge area. I mean, the Russians, they had a lot of time. They started fortifying the area around Luhansk and Oblast in autumn 2022, because that's when Ukraine was still attacking very actively in that area. But yeah, and then they had about 5 months to fortify just the southern part between Zaporizhia and Donetsk, where Ukraine tried their southern counteroffensive, and that was enough for them. But again, we're talking about the Russian state and the Russian traditional capacity to very effectively commit huge amounts of resources to mega projects like this. Unfortunately, Ukraine doesn't have those resources. Ukraine is in a very tricky financial situation as it is, and you know, people need to be paid for this work. You need to get the material, the building material. So it's a huge undertaking. It's a shame that they haven't really taken it seriously until now, but hopefully we'll see some movement.
We weten dat de Oekraïense opperbevelhebber Zaluzhny vroeger ongelooflijk veel leerde van de doctrine van Valery Gerasimov, de Russische generaal die eigenlijk het beleid lijkt uit te stippelen en de visie heeft als hij niet overrompeld wordt door Shoigu of Poetin of Patrushev of iemand anders. En ik ben toch benieuwd, ik wil toch graag even van Francis weten of hij denkt dat Zaluzhny eigenlijk hier eerder aan had moeten denken. Dat die verdedigingslijn zo'n essentieel onderdeel is van hoe je oorlog voert.
You know, Zaluzhny can't do it on his own. He can't make that decision on his own because of the resources required for that undertaking. And then, you know, it raises the question of communication and leadership, and you know, is who are the key people in that inner circle? We know that there are also some of the top generals, Sirsky, Tarnovsky. One of them is more close to Zaluzhny. One is more close to Zelensky. Then you have the defense ministry, and now they seem to have a working relationship. But unfortunately, you know, a lot of those decisions that should have been made earlier weren't. Before this new initiative and this new working group, fortifications were mostly handled by the regional civilian administration, so the oblast, the regional administrations. And that's what happened when I asked Zelensky about this at the press conference. He kind of avoided the question. He first avoided the question about how big these fortifications would be. Would they be similar to the scale we see, we saw from Russia? But when I also asked him, why is this only starting now? And he said, oh, it's not starting now because the regional civilian administrations, they've been working on this. And I travel around and sometimes I see that it's very good and very strong. They're doing good work. Sometimes I see that it's not strong enough, and that should be worked on more. But in that sense, he was also, unfortunately, kind of handing over responsibility for this, like, whereas he, as the supreme commander-in-chief, you know, who has both the civilians and the military kind of functions of the state underneath him, of course he should be responsible, but he kind of just admitted that, no, it's not my problem, it's the region's problem. So we'll see with this new working group, which is headed by the Defense Ministry and the Digital Transformation Ministry, with the participation of the general staff of the military, we'll see if they have a different approach. I think we've seen some satellite pictures, some videos of them getting to work, and we can just hope that they're taking it seriously.
Tijd voor het tweede onderwerp, om met Francis nog even kort aan te stippen. De mobilisatie, de vernieuwde mobilisatie, een mobilisatiewet die zowel Zelensky als Zaluzhny graag willen, omdat er nou eenmaal mensen nodig zijn om Oekraïne te verdedigen. En het met de huidige manier van mobiliseren, die te gedateerd is, niet genoeg tot stand komt. Maar Oekraïne is ook een democratie aan het worden. En heeft dus te maken met mensen, met allerlei inspraak, met allemaal individuen die op hun eigen manier kijken naar hoe zij hun leven zouden moeten invullen. Ook in oorlogstijd.
At the end of the year, around Christmas time, the cabinet of ministers, which is basically the defense ministry working together with the armed forces, put forward this mobilization draft law. And the whole point of the draft law, basically, you have the military and they have a need for people. They just need more people to make up for losses, to form reserves, to maybe form new brigades, and also, you know, perhaps once the legislation is there, to start demobilizing and rotating some of the soldiers who've fought for almost 2 years now. So the military needs these men. It's just no question. How many they need and how they are going to get them is another question. Unfortunately, and this is the responsibility of the military, unfortunately, Ukraine's recruiting enlistment officers have, over the last 2 years, got a really bad reputation. And it's not everywhere, but in some regions in particular, a bad reputation for you know, corruption, you pay off your local enlistment officer and you don't get mobilized, or you pay off the medical people and they give you a paper saying you're exempt. But also not only corruption, but also, you know, this kind of, maybe you've seen videos grabbing people on the street, young men, and taking them off and into the army. It's kind of crazy. It's something we like to make fun of when it happens in Russia, but it is happening in Ukraine now. But again, this need is simply unavoidable from the military side. And then you have the government, well, the parliament and the president, whose job it is to help the military fulfill that need, while still thinking of the interests and the rights of the civilian population and the economy as well. So their job, they had a look at this first draft law, which had a few aspects to it, including lowering the conscription age, introducing electronic, basically conscription notices. What else was there? There was the involvement of local government in the conscription process. And there was also stuff about like consequences for dodging the draft, where you could be added to the debtors register and you could have your assets frozen or taken away, that kind of thing. So that, yeah, the draft law arrived and there were a lot of issues with it. There were a lot of issues that were objectively problematic, that gave too much opportunity for corruption in different parts of this process. Opportunities that, well, yeah, things that kind of violated perhaps the constitution or basic human rights law. And so they had a look at it, and after some debate, they turned it back and said, try again. And so we can expect that another attempt to be made in the 1st of February. I'm quite optimistic that it will be passed. There will still be some debate. There'll be some amendments. But the thing is, again, there's no getting around this need. So you have to be basically, as much as you might want to win political points with civilians by trying to soften the draft law in the debates, that's what some of the opposition parties are doing, and even Zelensky's party is doing. But you can only do that for so long, because everyone understands the need for this, and there's no one who's going to outwardly sabotage it. So I think the next time it comes around in early February, it will get through after some debate.
So there is, or there will be, an understanding that if you need the number of roughly 500,000 people to serve in the army, there is an understanding you cannot reach that number without taking any draconian measures.
Well, I mean, I don't know about the exact breakdown of the numbers. Of course, the number of people to be mobilized is not stated in any kind of document. It's just a basic understanding of that's the scale of people that we need to mobilize. And this draft law is about giving the military the tools to expand their mobilization. And this question of the word draconian, I mean, I have seen it come up quite a few times. For me, there's nothing in the initial draft law that seems particularly draconian. It's just a very, very painful reality of this whole picture that is the trickiest part. You know, it's just the fact that, yes, the country needs to take all of these people off to war. And at this point in the war, you know, there are very few volunteer fighters at this point. At this point in the war, someone who's mobilized probably doesn't want to be mobilized. They probably want to keep living their civilian life. Maybe they're doing a lot for the army, donating, volunteering, contributing to the economy. They probably don't want to go and sit in a trench at this point, but they have to. And that, you know, it's difficult for me to personally, you know, come to any kind of judgment about what's right or wrong here, what's too draconian or not draconian enough, because I'm not eligible, I guess, to be sent off to the front line. I think, unfortunately, what I said about the military recruiting officers, you know, as much as they have that legal option to expand the recruiting, the mobilization, it's more important, in my opinion, that they sort out, you know, all of this bad reputation with the recruiting officers, with the enlistment officers, because that's a main issue that really demotivates people and makes them properly terrified of this concept of mobilization. And of course, there's another side to this draft law, which is the opposite, I guess, of draconian, which is something that people have been asking for a very long time, which is to finally have an expiry date on the service period of mobilized soldiers, which is they proposed 36 months. So 36 months, 3 years of full-scale war against Russia. I mean, it's very tough. We haven't even reached two yet. It's not a very generous offer, but at least it's something, right? At least people know that it's not forever.
One more anecdote from one of your pieces I'd like to mention. You've spoken to, you call him Mikhailo in Chernivtsi. He's an IT officer. You've spoken to him, but his name is not really his name because mm-hmm. he is... he doesn't want to be mobilized, so he's kind of avoiding being recruited. And he was telling you he's also not going on the streets because he doesn't want to be drafted, but also out of some kind of respect, because Mikhailo doesn't think he deserves to hang out around bars, to go out. So basically, he doesn't think he deserves to enjoy life since he is not prepared to risk his life. Is that something you hear more often?
It was really interesting to hear that because exactly this phenomenon of young, fit men just partying and hanging out in bars and cafes and going to the gym is a complaint that you hear a lot about soldiers. Not about soldiers, from soldiers. So soldiers on the front line who you know, point to this big gap in the perception of the war between military and civilians, and they say, you know, what do they think? We're just going to fight for them forever. Like, they need to join us, they need to replace us. But instead, they're just partying and going to the gym. And Mikhailo, like, he also he participates in this widespread culture in Ukraine of regularly donating a large portion of your income to the armed forces fundraisers to get cars and drones and things like that for the army. So, and you know, contributes to the economy. So I think, yeah, I mean, I really respected what he said about that. It makes sense for me. Again, I'm not a Ukrainian citizen, so I don't have the same kind of threat or pressure on me, but even for me, like, I wouldn't go, I can go to a bar, but I wouldn't go, I don't feel comfortable going to a techno party, for example, during wartime in Kyiv. Even though that scene has come back, it's just always finishing before curfew. And there are others. I know people who are also the same, who used to like go to a lot of raves or clubs or whatever, and now they don't want to because it just feels strange. And yeah, there's this respect, guilt aspect towards the soldiers as well.
Yeah. And curfew is now in Kyiv at 11 or 12. It changed, right?
12 o'clock, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Thanks, Francis, for sharing your stories with me, but also with the readers of the Kyiv Independent. Can I ask you what you're working on right now? What's your next story?
A few things, perhaps like an overall outlook on the strategic position in 2024, something about innovative new drones. I can't tell you too much, unfortunately, but until it comes out, and then maybe next week we'll go on another trip to the east.
Thank you. Francis Farrell from the Kiev Independent. Thank you so much. Dankjewel. En tot de volgende keer.
Tot de volgende keer. See you later.
Vanaf 1 juli moeten alle reizen van medewerkers gerapporteerd worden. Gelukkig maakt Shuttle die CO2-rapportage eenvoudig. Shuttle geeft medewerkers toegang tot alle vormen van vervoer en maakt automatisch een rapportage. Shuttle maakt mobiliteit voor iedereen leuker. Ga naar shuttel.nl.